Today's episode of You Look Hungry is brought to you by The Barter House. For more information, visit www.thebarterhouse.com.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.com.
You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio in Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this week, I'm joined by the Los Angeles-based duo, Alex Brown and Evan George, the creators of one of the most funny and delicious food blogs I've found, Hot Knives. Guys, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello.
Thanks for having us.
So yeah, unfortunately our magic telephone booth, a la Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, is broken, so we gotta do the phone chat today. But for those listeners out there who aren't familiar with Hot Knives, can you break off a little piece and tell them what it is?
Alex, break it off.
Here's how it works. We have a food blog that we've had for a number of years. We met in college as line cooks in the college mess hall at Occidental College. And when we weren't binge drinking Jägermeister, we were making small and elaborate meals for all of our lady friends from stuff we found at the farmer's market. And that's kind of what the blog's been. We go to the farmer's market, we find cool shit, take it home, play around with it. Oh, are bad words okay on this radio station?
I think for you guys, maybe so. I don't know.
Okay. I'll try to behave. I tend to spoil like this.
Don't hear yourself.
But besides that, you know, we pair every recipe that we create in our strange little world with a soundtrack and with a specialty beer. And I think that kind of encapsulates most things. We recently broke into the world of print. Maybe Evan wants to talk about that.
Well, I think the other thing that the blog has kind of become is a sounding board for what we do in the kitchen, because we, like deep, screw another thumb and figured out how to use cell phones and video cameras. And so it's been kind of a video blog for the last couple of years, which gives us a platform to kind of show what screwing around in the kitchen is like for us. And so that's been a lot of fun.
You guys started Hot Knives in 2005. How do you think, you know, it was sort of back in the day of the horse and buggy years of the food blog scene. Like, how have things changed for you since you got started with it?
Good question. I mean, Alex, you want to take it?
Well, I think, I mean, the first thing mainly was that, I mean, back then we were one of, I mean, more food blogs back then were either, you know, people going to restaurants to mixed review from restaurateurs and other eaters, and you know, writing their opinions, whether or not people really cared to listen, and more recipe blogs. I think they still are to a certain extent. Just people who, you know, would get a cookbook or would go to a restaurant and eat something and then try to make it at home. There wasn't a lot of like original content, but food blogs also sort of like were really like static in what they did, which I think horse and buggy days are still true. Like what Evan was just talking about, how we do, you know, we do recipes and we make funny videos and we write about beer and cheese and lots of other things. I think that the food blog world is still pretty vanilla and static. I don't know.
I remember vividly in 2005-ish when we were first starting to blog, looking at this thing called Food Porn Daily, which was sort of like the catch-all like site that would try and cobble together what food posts were up that day or that week. And it was very much like the food blog equivalent of video games you used to play in the 80s, like I think Castle is one that I remember, where there's no images. It's just line after line after line of like, turn left, you see a gnome, you see a, like, do you want to pull your sword? Like the most basic the most basic version of like a video game you can imagine on a computer. That's kind of what food blog world was like in 2005, where it was just a long, long list of like, you know, posts that day. And I remember thinking, like, how can we crack this? How can we get mentioned on this really obscure, unhelpful, like, just log roll of like blogs? And you look at, you know, nowadays, people who blog about restaurants and you know, cooking, it's definitely gone, you know, further than I would have thought at the time. And I think the other interesting thing about recipe blogs is they have gotten pretty elaborate. Even if it's a home cook, people who take 80 photos of them making macaroni and cheese, and there's a giant high-res photo of each step, is pretty mind-boggling.
And sponsorship for every single thing that they use. And their camera. Don't forget that camera.
Well, so I'm not a vegetarian, but your new cookbook, Salad Daze, spelled D-A-Z-E, is definitely hypnotizing me into wanting to become one. What do people, like, what can people expect to find in this cookbook?
Go, George.
Well, we set out kind of wanting to have a whole section of homemade condiments. We, you know, had actually thought originally, and maybe still will, of doing like a condiment cookbook. So there was, we wanted to kind of start from that sort of scratch level of like, okay, if you want to make cock sauce yourself, if you want to make, you know, Worcestershire sauce, ketchup, those kinds of things, as sort of like a base level for recipes, we'll include that. So there's, you know, dressings and various sort of pantry items, a lot of which we try and make almost just from kind of produce. So, for instance, we have a kimchi recipe. Obviously, it doesn't involve shrimp paste. It doesn't involve actually anything but stuff that you could get at the farmer's market. So you make a paste using chilies and garlic and ginger, and you let it ferment out for a while, and then you sort of use that, and there's no soy sauce, there's no, you know, sugar, it's just vegetables. And so that's sort of like the starting point, and we try and take that all the way to desserts, you know, hitting soups and stews and like fried rice dishes and salads. And the way we kind of tried to organize it was everything in there is basically a composed or deconstructed salad, if you want to think about it that way. Since there is no meat protein, we kind of thought of it as salad dishes, but taken to sort of an extreme degree.
Yeah, like, you know, there's this great, like, Dennis Leary stand-up that I used to listen to in high school, and he really, I mean, and I used to be the the meat eater that made fun of all my vegetarian friends relentlessly when I was a youth, and there's a really good bit where he's like, you know, someone goes to a restaurant, take a vegetarian to a restaurant, like, what would you like to eat, sir? Broccoli, you know? And it's kind of taking that idea and turning it on its head that, like, well, yeah, like, everything that we eat is salad. It's just different levels of composition and different levels of attention and manipulation. And I mean, some of the recipes in the book are, you know, they're branded simple. It's not a lot of technique and it's not a lot of time. And some of them were, you know, they're a little, they take some time and they're a little more anal retentive, but we tried to make it, and we've always tried to have it be this way with the blog too, to be it as educational as we can be in helping people just sort of see the game or the problem, if you will, for some people, of making awesome vegetarian food just from a different angle. And yeah, I mean, we're targeting you, Helen. We want you meat eaters to eat your vegetables, and hopefully this is kind of a fun way that you can do that.
Well, yeah, and this book, I mean, this is sort of directed towards winter vegetables, right? Because you also have the forthcoming cookbook, Spring Daze, right?
Spring Blaze.
Spring Blaze. How could you? What's, from each of you, what's maybe one of your favorite recipes from Salad Days and why?
I want to eat, like, currently, the portobello poutine, which is basically elaborate braised portobellos turned into portobello fries and then served with a sort of gravy made from the braising liquid droppings that drip, that get reduced. And because it's actually cold in Los Angeles right now, I mean, I'm in my car drinking coffee with a hoodie on. I really would like to eat that this week. And it's one of the recipes that's a little bit more elaborate. It's kind of a riff. I mean, you can find portobello fries places, but to get sort of like a weird braised gravy out of it that's vegetarian, it's super deep and umami and very wintry. That's something that I find myself wanting to make again and again.
Do you think the folks in Quebec, where it sort of comes from, do you think they'd approve?
Well, we have an artist friend up there who just sent us a photo of herself holding up the cookbook and smiling. So she either hadn't gotten to that page yet or Quebec approves.
Yeah, the Quebecois can be, I mean, they can be vicious about those poutines, I know. But, you know, they can be nice too, right? Isn't that the thing with Canada?
I think Canadians are probably nice, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Alex, what do you
what
think?
What about you, Alex?
Yeah.
Well, we just had the blessed luxury of being photographed in Evan's kitchen for a forthcoming piece in our local newspaper, right. The LA Times, and that's actually the same kitchen that the cover shot's taken in, and we wanted to make something so it wouldn't just be us, like, you know, standing around looking goofy, and we made the savory rolls, which is a recipe that we had this. It only lasted 2 years, but we almost did it for 3 years, but where we, on New Year's Eve, at the height of being, you know, incredibly wasted on various things, would make elaborate baked goods for the next day. So this was the first year that we did it. The second year, we made bagels at like 4 a.m. in the middle of this like really ripping party. But the first year we did it, we made savory rolls. We wanted to make, you know, awesome cinnamon rolls, but instead of like cinnamon sugar and butter, we used pompe and we used like all these different herbs. And we made this kind of like, you know, gooey like shallot jam. So it, you know, they almost look exactly like sweet rolls, except they have, you know, green things and cheese oozing out of them. But it's such an indulgent and wonderful thing for any time of the day.
Well, you sound like a really efficient drunk, because I feel like 4 a.m. making any baked good is a very difficult task to pull off. So I'm impressed.
Anybody who thinks they can cook or bake drunk should try making bagels at 5 a.m. on New Year's Day, because that was a task.
That was pretty ridiculous.
I feel like, yeah, that's terrifying. How do you still have eyebrows? It's impressive. We're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we've got more from the duo behind Hot Knives. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. Keep it locked.
They were curious orange. nine times out of 10, when someone is taking the time to break away and do their own thing, it's because they either have a specific point of view or a specific passion that really sort of speaks to maybe not a mass audience, but the customers that I have and the customers that Barterhouse tries to culture and cultivate, I think are those type of people who want that story and feel like if they take an allocation of an 80 case made wine, that they've got something special and it's something that only they have or maybe one other person has. So that's kind of what we specialize in. And, you know, it may not be business savvy to the nth degree, like we're not making 100,000 cases of Pinot Grigio and, you know, flogging them all over New York, but the customers that get wine from us are kind of believing the same stuff we do, which is supporting these small farms, supporting these young winemakers who have a passion for doing it. And we supply them with a market and we allow them to get their product out there to otherwise an untapped group of people.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman. And I'm joined today by Los Angeles-based amazing blogger duo Alex Brown and Evan George, the wizards behind Hot Knives. And we've been talking about a lot of things, but most of all, we've been talking about Salad Days, their new cookbook, which is out in stores now. It's pretty amazing. And, you know, you guys have this ability to sort of pull like a David Blaine on vegetables. You know, you transform something that seems really simple or dull into something really full-fledged and elegant, which is kind of trite of me to say, but it's true. And I mean, you got tricks. Like I feel like I read somewhere you were talking about how to transform low-grade olive oil into high-grade. And first, can you tell people how you do that? And also, like, what are some other kitchen tricks that you have up your sleeves you like to pull out sometimes?
Gotcha. Before the trickery and the tomfoolery. you got to talk about the trick, man. But we have to brainstorm our other tricks.
So the olive oil is a great poor man's trick, especially if maybe 2 years ago you were buying fancy shit and now you find yourself out of a job and you don't want to wean yourself off of the $30 bottle. What we found works really well is take a $5, $6, $7 bottle of olive oil, you know, any routine like Kalamata olive oil from Trader Joe's or whatever, and simply pulse it with some decent black cured olives in a food processor, pitted, obviously, for maybe a minute or so. You'll get this really sludgy, like, petrol-looking stuff. And you want to just let it sit like that for a minute, strain it. Actually, let it sit for, like, an hour to flavor. Strain it, and you've got this sort of noticeably darker olive oil that, when you taste it, will taste like olives in the way that a good $30 bottle of olive oil should. And you know, this does take an hour. It does take getting some olives. It's not like, I'm not going to do it on the street corner, but it is an easy way to boost flavor, trick people, etc. And we use it in one of the recipes in the book, and it's in one of the sort of like trickery sections on sauces.
What's another wicked tip that you have like that? That I can pretend is my own.
Yeah. Well, before we can fully get into trickery, just one step back. You know, there's a whole lot in the book too that's dedicated, I mean, to us kind of being on a soapbox about product and about ingredients. And you know, one of our big claims that you really do get what you pay for. So there's literally an entire page dedicated to helping you find better olive oil that might just cost $30 a bottle. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Touche.
Yeah. Many other tricks all over.
over the place.
It sounds like basically what you're trying to say is go buy salad days, right?
Yeah. Well, not just that, but just that, you know, there's, I think that one of the a sort of interesting conundrum that we've created in our writing over the years is that, you know, we try to champion the cheap and the cost effective, and we want to debase the claim that, you know, you have to be employed by, to get real topical here, that you have to be employed by the 1% or something to, like, eat well is kind of stupid. And we definitely try to use, you know, cheap tricks of the trade that we either learned in kitchens or we taught ourselves. But we also, you know, like to proclaim that, you know, a lot of the expensive shit out there is expensive because, you know, you buy it, you're also supporting, you know, awesome small production scale humans that, you know, that are dedicated to making something awesome for you. So I also think
there are tricks in the book that have nothing to do with cost effectiveness. And that,
of course,
I think that comes from being home cooks for years and years and years. I mean, we've worked in kitchens, but we've also spent most of our time recently just, like, cooking for ourselves, cooking with each other. And you develop, you know, home cook tricks that aren't restaurant tricks. And so home cooks writing cookbooks will have certain fun tidbits, kind of mind benders. I mean, there's one recipe that the whole conceit is that it looks like a psychedelic trip, right? So it's a rice salad that looks trippy as hell. And one of the tricks is you roast red beets, you roast golden beets, you lay them sort of half on top of one another overnight in the fridge, and when you pull them out, it's a tie-dye, like, beet salad, essentially. And you throw these beets into the purple rice salad, and it's kind of like a crazy color explosion, and you wouldn't get that unless you take the time to tie-dye, quote-unquote, the beets. And I don't know, I think that there's a level of attention that, you know, only weirdo stoners would give to making a beef salad.
Totally. Go ahead. No, go.
No. Beet blood sort of became this, like, this trope that we used a lot, and that we, you know, we only ended up, I think, using beet stained things twice in the book. The first and definitely the least gruesome looking of the two was that psychedelic salad that Evan was talking about. The other one being this super gnarly trick of marinating and then braising skinned king oyster mushrooms in beet juice. So they literally absorb the beet liquid. And then when you cook them, they look very, very meat-like. And when you cut into them, they literally bleed.
Oh, man. That sounds delicious, though.
Yeah. I mean, it was a trick that when it was first executed, we showed it to our, you know, we showed it to our respective lady friend life partners, and they were both first totally grossed out and then loved eating them. So it works.
And it essentially looks like filet mignon for vegans. Whether they want to be eating filet mignon or not.
I've seen some party pics of those, and it definitely does look like blood sausage, for real. It looks good. I want to back up. You know, you guys chose the commercial break song, which was...
Curious Orange and a J.
Yeah, so, I mean, throughout the book, you have a playlist with, like, every single recipe has a beer pairing and a song. How did you guys pick all of... How did that process go?
Well, we have it down to a science at this point because we've been doing it since 2005. Both of us come from, you know, punk rock backgrounds, at least in terms of, like, you know, being in bands and stuff. And depending on when, you know, what we feel like sort of describing our process as, because it changes all the time, for the book at least, we really did sit down with all of the recipes in front of us and spend a good 5 hours pontificating, debating, playing records. We try and not be too literal all the time with why a song gets paired with food. I mean, it's kind of a goofy thing if you think about it. But for us, a lot of the times it's more about what makes sense to listen to while you're preparing it, what encapsulates the vibe of a sort of kitchen movement to a dish. Alex?
Yeah, I think it's more, I mean, the world of food pairing is really fraught, isn't it? And it's such a, like, it's such a dumb thing in so many ways. And we've come across, you know, these really hilarious looking, and not to be mean, but I mean, really hilarious looking, you know, music pairing blogs, you know, pairing music with wines and stuff like that. And then, you know, in the real world or whatever, when you go to a restaurant, like, I feel like 90% of the time what you're listening to doesn't correspond to what you're eating or where you are at all. And like Evan said, I think it's better to think about, and this is, again, it speaks more to our approach and our way, because we want people to have fun in the kitchen. We want them to be psyched about, you know, about making food for their friends and loved ones, and that the process itself is almost as much fun as the payoff. And so it's not explicitly stated anywhere in our, you know, in our scientific method that, you know, that most of the songs are really about the process, but they kind of are. And so is the beer, which is funny too. I mean, the beer will obviously also go with what you're going to eat, but it's also more about the fun of the process. It's the thrill of the hunt, you know? And so it doesn't, we sort of try to stay away from that mamby-pamby, like, you know, this delicate, pernicious thing where, like, every second, like, aligns with something else, which I think is presumptuous.
Yeah, I mean, we hope to come off as deeply tongue-in-cheek at times, but the truth is, we really need music when we're cooking, and the idea of being able to share, like, a playlist in general, like at the back of the book, because it's all cobbled together in one place, is just awesome. We wouldn't want to not include that. I mean, we did a beer zine last year where the bookmark was actually a link to download all of the songs that went with all the beers. I mean, obviously we couldn't do that with a book and not get sued, but we want to be able to share that part of the experience with people.
New York, we have things like the Brooklyn Flea that are going on. What are some of the things going on in L.A.? At least I'm excited about the Brooklyn Flea. I can't speak for all people in the tri-state. But what are some things going on in the L.A. food scene you guys are really into, besides yourselves, obviously?
grilled cheese.
Yeah, the grilled cheese invitational is always something that we hold dear. And it's, you know, it was our first... Do you guys know what that is?
Pretend that we're, like, living under a rock, basically.
It's pretty cool. I mean, I'm surprised you guys don't have one yet. It's been slowly virally creeping east. So eventually you guys will get the disease too. But it's sort of born, and it's our only connection to the burner or post burner, whatever culture it is. Where a bunch of friends used to just get together at someone's warehouse and compete against each other with grilled cheese sandwiches, and who won was decided by the crowd in the sort of democratic way, and it's grown from
and taking it very seriously with trophies,
very
and
seriously
costumes.
With yeah costumes. The first year we competed, which was really weird, the women that won the dessert grilled cheese category, I think, literally just made a Kraft Singles grilled cheese and sprayed whipped cream and chocolate sauce on it, but they were both only wearing latex aprons, and they just made out the entire time. And so the performance, ultimately, was what pushed them to victory. We've never done anything like that.
Or it was the Kraft cheese. Did you ever think about that?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe. No. Defy that.
You know, sadly, we gotta wrap things up, but you can find Salad Days at Barnes & Noble, right?
Yeah.
find it everywhere between anarchist collectives to Walmart.
Whoa. That is a wide bracket.
A to W.
Hot damn. Well, if you're interested in learning more about Alex and Evan and you want to check out Hot Knives, the blog, it is urbanhonking.com/hotknives. Did I get that right?
You got it.
You could also stalk them on Twitter. Look for Hot Knives. And it is the holiday season, so go get thyself to a bookstore and check this out, because it really is, without giving too much of my personal opinion away, one of the best cookbooks I've seen in a while. So thank you, men, for coming on the show. Thanks to Jack Inslee, the rest of the crew at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Helen Holliman. I'll see y'all next time.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat. Turkey and jam, macaroni and ham. Say, do you like steak?
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a message from Jones Family Farms. Looking for that perfect Christmas tree this season? What about the perfect wine to go with your holiday dinner? Look no further than Jones Family Farm, a 400-acre working farm in Connecticut. Jones Family Farms is as passionate about education as it is about farming. Whether you're picking fresh strawberries or exploring local wines, we hope you're inspired to learn more about Connecticut farming. For more information, visit www.jonesfamilyfarms.com. This is a message from Sea to Table. Can the fish come back to South Street? On December 18th, the New Amsterdam Market will pay homage to the old Fulton Fish Market by including a special section dedicated to the fisheries of the Northeast and New England with Sea to Table. Sea to Table partners with fishermen in the recovering fisheries of the Northeast. Their transparent model, delivering fish direct from docks to chefs across America, supports the traditional fisheries that are crucial to the survival of our working waterfronts. For the first time, Sea to Table will join the market to offer fresh fish direct from independent Northeast fishermen. The collaboration of Sea to Table with New Amsterdam will take us back in time for a day to the era when fishmongers dominated Lower Manhattan. So stop by the New Amsterdam Market at Peck Slip and South Street in Manhattan on December 18th and support your local fishermen and fisheries. For more information on Sea to Table, visit www.sea2table.com. That's C, S-E-A, the number 2, table.com.